Welcome to another episode of Text to Task Simplifying Education. I am Gargi, and today we have a special guest, Peter Del Scott, an accomplished poet, political thinker, and former diplomat. Peter has had an incredible journey in both academia and the foreign service, with unique ideas that shape our understanding of global events. After a chance encounter with him, I knew I had to share his insights with you. If you are interested in poetry or curious about how to write a poem, this episode is perfect for you. Let's dive into this exciting conversation about poetry, politics, and more. Today, we have the rare opportunity to hear from a man whose words have the power to illuminate, provoke thought, and inspire change. Please join me in welcoming the esteemed poet and professor, Peter Del Scott. Thank you, Peter, for joining us today.
Well, I'm very happy to be talking to you. I don't have many chances to talk to people in Southeast Asia.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to host you. So my first question to you is, what significant changes have you observed in poetry and literature throughout your career?
Well, this has been a time of great changes in the world, and so everybody's poetry has changed in response. What I particularly notice in America is that we have a lot of new movements, people who were silent before and became more active, women, for example, and African Americans. And we've had a lot more women's poetry, a lot more African American poetry in English, of course, and Asian American poetry. That's in America, a significant group of people now. I've known some of the prominent ones myself. And this has been very good. I think it's a better world when all these people are writing to represent their own communities. I also hope that we don't lose sight of the things that keep us all together, so that as things settle down, I hope that they will mix the special audience with general audience. I've always myself tried to write for general audiences, but that is the change that I've been particularly struck by.
Additionally, how have your personal experiences and historical events influenced your poetry?
Well, America, I came to America. I had been a Canadian diplomat in Canada. And then when I came to America in 1961, I had no idea how much America was in the course of changing. We had the civil rights movement, and that very soon in Berkeley in particular, where I was, led to a student movement in Berkeley that briefly was famous around the world, the free speech movement. And I got involved with this movement, and it became an anti-war movement. America was fighting the war in Vietnam. And I knew a little bit about Vietnam from my experiences as a diplomat. For everybody's sake, including America's, I didn't want America in Vietnam. So I became part of the anti-war movement, and my poetry became anti-war poetry, and I've been involved in other things since then. I spent my good deal of my spare time, and I was always a professor and loved that, but I was also an activist, and my poetry reflects my various involvements as an activist. And I believe that that's a good, you know, everyone can write their own kind of poetry, but I'm quite happy that my poetry became more involved in trying to make this a better world, which I think that's one of the things that poetry can do. And I was happy in my small way to contribute to that effort.
Thank you Moreover, how has your approach to writing poetry evolved over the years?
I have to mention that when I came to Berkeley, there was a very famous, well, he was not so famous then, a Polish poet from Poland called Czesław Miłosz. And in 1980, which was years later, he eventually won the Nobel Prize in Literature and became very famous. But he just came to Berkeley 1 year before I did. I came from Poland and I knew Polish. I had known his brother. And I looked him up, and for 6 years, I was his, probably the only published poet who was translating his poetry. His first poem in English was translated by me, as he said, with his minor assistance. So for 6 years, I worked with him. He was a very good poet, and he influenced my style. He was somebody, how shall I say it? He concentrated on the spirit of what he was trying to say in the poem as a whole. He didn't worry too much about the exact words. We have workshops in America where they put a lot of effort into getting the exact phrase and so on. And I was started more or less that way, but I became less interested in getting the exact word and more interested in getting the spirit of a poem, which was what I think he did very successfully in his poetry. So that was evolved that way because of Czesław Miłosz.
Furthermore, what advice would you offer to emerging poets and writers?
Well, I think a lot of the advice I would give is don't have too exact an idea of what you're going to write before you write it. In other words, don't be too intentional about your poem. For me, my own experience is that I often don't know I'm going to write a poem, and then something comes into my mind. And first of all, I say, oh, well, I'll think about that later, and then it's still there. And the poem says, no, write me now. And the poem tells me to write it. And then my advice is, if you have that kind of inspiration, we used to say, if the muse comes to you and tells you to write, then learn to listen to the muse and let the muse guide you. Don't try to guide the muse. That would be my advice.
In the light of the rise of digital media and technology, how do you think this has impacted the world of poetry?
Oh, that is a very big question. I have to give you a short answer. It's going to be hard. The positive side is that digital media and the internet have vastly expanded our frontiers. I've talked to people in Indonesia, I've talked to people in East Timor, I've talked to people in China, all over the world. And that, of course, has affected my poetry, and you see it in everybody, that we live in a more global era now, with a more global culture. That doesn't mean the end of local culture. In some ways, it liberates local culture. It means, I think, that national cultures are less important, local culture is more important, and global culture more important. I totally approve all of that. But that's not the only way that it's impacted the world of poetry. I think also that there are some people who, I'm not one of them, and I don't approve of this, but there are some people who have become more interested in various kinds of experiments you can play with language. They're not particularly interested in saying anything. If anything, they try to make sure they're not saying something. They just want to explore language. And I think computers have made it much easy to go very far in that direction. I'm all for everyone doing what they want to do, but in poetry. But I don't think that's been as positive as the expansion of our mental frontiers, which I think is very, very, very crucial, really, to the future of the world. If we're going to have a peaceful world, we need to have global poets. We have to have poets who can write to people in India and America and England and Africa, and the digital media help us to get that kind of poet. And that's what I would want to emphasize as being the most positive development.
You were a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. How has your experience as a teacher influenced your writing? And vice versa.
Well, I don't really know. Somebody else would be a better judge, but I suspect my poetry tends to be a bit, what we could say, didactic. It's poetry that is telling people things and trying to persuade them. And I think that's a habit that can be a bad habit in poetry. You don't want to be too much that way. Although very great poetry can be didactic. You know, Keats's Ode to a Grecian Urn is a very great poem, and he ends up telling you that beauty is truth, truth, beauty. He has something to say, to tell. So it's all right to have something to tell, but you don't want to overdo that. And I just hope that teaching hasn't overemphasized I think somebody said in antiquity that poetry should delight and instruct both. And I hope that my impulse to instruct has not overcome my wish, a genuine wish, where it's my muse's wish, actually. I write something if it delights me, and I want to delight others. So I don't know if that has influenced my writing, but when you said vice versa, I think being a teacher and seeing how people react and the things that they do react to and the things they don't react to. I once met a student of mine 20 years later, and the only thing she remembered from a year-long course was a personal anecdote that was irrelevant to the course. So I learned that you can't count on teaching too much, and maybe I became more conscious of the importance of reader reaction, which of course is important. When you write a poem, you're writing a poem to be read by other people. In a sense, it isn't really a poem until someone else is reading it and making it enter their mind, and the experience they have is the ultimate thing that validates a poem, a real poem, as opposed to a not good poem. So that's my response.
Now, Peter, I have some questions about your process of writing poetry. So my first question is, describe your typical writing routine when working on a new poem.
I may have already said that I don't always know when I'm going to write a poem. I may be working on something else and my mind gets distracted. That's when the muse comes knocking. And to me, I try only, well, once I've started a poem, that's something else. But to begin a poem, I wait for something inside me to say, maybe it's just a turn of three or four words together, or maybe an image, something quite simple. And I say, oh, that could be a poem. And then this happens all the time. And then many times I just put it to one side, but sometimes it comes back, and the image or the words or whatever it is, they stay in my mind, even if I'm trying to think about something else. And that's when I'll say, okay, this poem is here, and as a poet, I give priority to poetry. And so, you know, many people then will reach for a pad and a pen. I write my poems on my computer. And some people say, that's awful, that's terrible. T.S. Eliot, I think, was a very great poet, and he used to write his poems on a typewriter. And for years, I did. One of my most famous poems actually starts by describing the typewriter that I'm typing it into that's coming to Jakarta, which is one of my poems that has been translated. And so it's quite possible to let you, it frees my mind just to think about the poem, because I can type quicker than I can write. And if I make typos, type the wrong words by mistake, it doesn't matter, I can correct them. So personally, that's how I write a poem.
So my next question is, yes. So my next question is, how do you balance spontaneity and structure in your poems then?
How do I balance structure and what?
Spontaneity. You are telling, you just told me that the poetry comes to you spontaneously. You don't start writing.
Yes, I see.
So how do you balance that? Then how do you put it in the structure of the poem then? When that muse strikes you, how do you put it in that structure?
That's a very good question. I think there are always, and Miłosz wrote about, he answered this question for himself. And he said there are two phases, and I agree with him, by the way. Of course, I model myself on him, but I think I always believe this. The first stage is the spontaneous page. The poem writes itself. You write it down very quickly. One of his very famous poems, he says he wrote in half an hour, the first draft. But then you look at it and you try to make it a better poem, and that's where the structure comes in. And you can see where it's missing something. For example, 2 days ago, I wrote two poems, and I wrote them on the computer, and I realized that there's a third poem going to come. The structure that's in the two poems said there had to be a third poem. And quite confidently, I'm waiting for the third poem to come. I think it will. I may have to nudge it a bit, but it will come. And So it's spontaneity first. Second stage, you worry about structure, coherence, and just a bit, and about all these other things, about just how it sounds, the cadence, the rhythm, the meter, all these things you worry about, but you don't worry about in the first phase. You're just responding to the experience that is inspiring the poem to begin with.
So how do you decide when a poem is finished and ready to be shared with others?
I'm always very greedy to hear what other people think. And very often when I think a poem is finished, my friends that I share with, they don't. And so the answer is I don't know when a poem is finished. And I do know that in my last book of poetry, I don't know whether people can see this book, Dreamcraft, there is a poem in there that rewrites a poem that I published in an earlier book from the same publisher 24 years ago. And so I thought then it was finished, and 2 years ago I thought it wasn't finished. So in a sense, you never know that a poem is finished. Auden was famous for rewriting his poems. The trouble was W.H. Auden was a very great poet, but I think his brilliant poetry was when he was young. And when he started rewriting his poems, I think he had less talent than when he first wrote them. So most people prefer the early versions to the late versions.
So how do you handle writer's block or periods of creative drought?
Yes, well, I had acute writer's block when I was young. And I had it more in prose than in poetry. It was so bad in my prose that I almost didn't finish university. My writer's block was so bad. And my first book of prose and my first book of poetry were both in my late 30s. Poetry has been, because of what I've described, it hasn't been as much, the writer's block usually comes, well, long poems. I've written some very long poems. In fact, I'm probably most famous for a trilogy of three long poems. Each of them is book length. and I had writer's block badly in writing. Once I got started, and then I had a structure, and then there were gaps in the structure, and I had to fill the gaps. And here I did have to be intentional to some extent, and that's when I would have the writer's block. But writer's block was a huge problem to me when I was young, not in prose, not a problem now. And no, on the contrary, I write too much. In poetry, less, but all you can do is, I think, relax. Don't try to sort of force your way through. That's not going to produce good prose or poetry. Relax and get in the right mood again. And when this was different at university, I had deadlines at the university, and I got some bad grades as a result. Especially now I'm retired, I can take as long as I like. I just wait, be patient, and let the writing come when it's ready.
So my last question is, what advice would you give to poets who are just starting to develop their own writing process?
Ah, yes. Well, I would say that in my case, I very much recommend taking a poet you recognize as being a brilliant poet, but in another language which you know, and then translate that poet into your own language, and especially if it's a poem that's never been in your own language before. And I suspect there are a lot of English language poets that have never been translated into Urdu or Hindi or any of the Asian languages. And then you have the excitement of saying something great in your own language that has never been said before. I had that experience when I was translating from Polish, and I started with another poet, Zbigniew Herbert, also could have won the Nobel Prize. And it really inspired me to have these wonderful phrases in English that, it, as far as I knew, had never been in English before. I was the first one. So anyone, any young poet can have that exciting experience by taking a poem from another language that is a great poem and translating it, being the first person to do that. That might be my advice.
That's a wrap on today's episode of Text to Task Simplifying Education. As always, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with friends and colleagues. Until next time, keep learning and stay curious.